From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it's been a long time coming. But today, Donald Trump finally addressed his stance on the so-called birther issue. That is the movement which questioned whether or not President Obama was born in the United States. He was. Donald Trump was a leader of that movement for years. Here he was today at an event in Washington.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, joining us now is political analyst and Republican strategist and Trump supporter, Paris Denard. Paris, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
And worth pointing out just right at the top that what Trump said there, that Hillary Clinton started the controversy, that is not true. It's been fact-checked. It's not true. But what did you make of what he did today?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right to point out to the audience that it wasn't Secretary Clinton who raised that issue. It was Clinton surrogates and people that were supporting her back in 07 and 08 who started that. But I think what today was a good day for America, a good day for the country, because what it does is it hits the political reset button so that everyone who had an issue with Mr. Trump not saying that President Obama was born in the country, he said it today. His action was backed up by the press release or the statement that the campaign put out yesterday. And so now, hopefully, the Clinton campaign and people that are working on the other side of the aisle can move past this issue, which I believe has been dormant for several years, and talk about real issues that people of color especially are concerned about. And I believe it's things like school choice and jobs and crime in some of our inner cities.
Well, but when you say it's been dormant for several years, I just want to play a little bit of tape here from Donald Trump. This is him.
Sure.
Well, here he is back in 2011. He was speaking. This is on the day that President Obama released his official long-form birth certificate, and Trump spoke with CNN's John King.
Are you at all maybe a little embarrassed for stoking what many in the country see as a foolish debate?
No, I think I really did a great job in getting him to, I mean, first of all, I haven't seen it. You're just, I'm looking at that.
Yeah,
it doesn't, I'll look at it later.
Right.
I don't need to look at your copy, but I hope it's, everything's perfect.
And then here he is in March of last year on Fox News.
Hillary was the original. She was questioning Obama. Then John McCain questioned, but they never got anything. When I questioned, he gave whatever it was he gave. I'm not exactly sure what he gave, but he gave something called a birth certificate. I don't know if it was or not.
So even then, just last year, he was questioning whether the birth certificate was real.
Yeah, and I think the point I was making was that him making it a point of being the leader or out front on the issue, I think what you played 5 years ago and last year were him responding to questions about it. But in terms of him being a central part of the campaign or what he was talking about as a public official in this capacity as running for office, it has not been an issue.
But doesn't he have to be ready to answer questions about something that he raised?
And I think that's what you played 5 years ago and last year. He was responding to it. And now, I believe when he was had a consistent and significant effort and engagement with the African-American community these past several weeks that has been ramped up from what he's been doing all along, I think the Hillary Clinton campaign, when you look at the poll numbers and how they're increasing for Mr. Trump, especially in communities of color, I think they were threatened by it and decided to resurface this issue and make it a campaign issue when it wasn't one for so long.
Paris, he's been doing this more broadly, this outreach to African Americans over the last few weeks. And there was this moment this week in Flint, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump went there. And while he was giving a political speech there to an African American church, the pastor came over and said, "Mr. Trump, I invited you here to thank us in Flint, not to give a political speech." And he then went back to thanking them. But then the next day he came out and started going after her. Does that help him with African Americans, or does it undo all of the things that he's been trying to do to fix his image with African Americans?
Look, I think any time the Republican nominee for president engages with the African-American community and talks about issues that affects our community, I think it's a positive thing. And I don't think one responds to the way he felt the minister, the reverend, was acting around him is going to unravel the, in some polls that show him at 8% support that's and growing that he has in the community. The facts are Mr. Trump is the Republican nominee for president, and he is engaging with the black community like never before. And that is a good thing, not only for America, but it's a good thing for African Americans, because we should be having our interests and our issues on both sides of the aisle. And I would like to see Secretary Clinton's campaign be just as engaged, as well as Mr. Trump's campaign continue to be engaged and do even more as it relates to trying to earn the vote of African Americans.
Paris, 10 days to go until the first debate.
I can't believe it.
As a Republican strategist, what would be your advice to Trump right now?
My advice to Mr. Trump would be stick to policy and show yourself to be a proven leader that has the background to lead the country. There are a lot of people out there that want to vote for him, I believe, but want to hear him give them a reason. And if he gives them a reason, I believe he's going to vote, because Secretary Clinton has been on the scene for over 20, 30 years. We know her. We've listened to her. We want something new. We want something different. And I think he can do it, but he has to give the American people and those undecided and independent voters who are not flocking to Secretary Clinton a reason to do so. Stick to what he's good at, the economy, jobs, and he can win.
Paris Denard, here and now, political analyst and a Republican strategist and a Trump supporter. Paris, thanks as always.
Have a good weekend, Jeremy.
You too.
Today is a big day for Apple. The company's iPhone 7 goes on sale, as those Apple phones often do. Customers have been camped out at stores from Miami Beach to Houston. In fact, Apple stock hit an all-time high yesterday. But Apple's also been getting some negative press this week. In leaked emails, employees described a, quote, misogynistic, sexist environment. One woman said that her male colleagues told rape jokes in front of her. A male employee said that he was emotional, was told he was emotional, and acted like a woman. Femi Oke joins us from Washington now to look at what's been getting attention online. She is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there.
Excerpts of the leaked emails were published by the news site Mike. Can you tell us what the overall nature of the allegations against Apple were?
It was about creating a culture or having a culture where there are so many men that women and minorities feel like they're at a distinct disadvantage. Not just that, but also aggressions, microaggressions in their daily life. Let me give you a couple of examples. There was an office occasion when a woman working at Apple said that her male colleagues were joking about an intruder coming to rape everybody. When she raised that as a complaint, it wasn't taken very seriously. In fact, she raised it all the way up to the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook. Nothing happened. And that was just the end of a series of sexist harassment that she said she had found. Another Apple worker, female Apple worker, said that she was in a meeting, all-male meeting. She was the only female. All the men described the women in their lives in very derogatory terms. As she walked out of the meeting, she was told to smile more. Gives you an example of some of the things that have been happening to some employees at Apple, including men as well. One gentleman was described as being so emotional. Are you on your man period?
According to Apple, women make up 32% of its workforce around the world. The company has said that it wants to hire more women and minorities. I want to ask you about something, though. We remember the prominent New York Times story last year about Amazon that described a notoriously intense work environment, employees being pushed to the brink. Some of them would even break out in tears when they were at their desks. What do you make of these stories? Amazon's story reached the front page of the New York Times. Apple's is on Mike Online. How do you judge what these stories really do or do not say about the work cultures?
They grab our attention because they are huge companies, huge successful companies. You may remember that story about Apple and its workforce in China, the working conditions that the workforce was being asked to work under, the lack of remuneration that they were being worked under, which is in direct contrast to how successful the Apple brand is and all of their products. That's why we're looking at these stories. I was just looking to see what the online reaction was. Samantha Cole puts it quite well on Twitter. Please 100% believe that the white male Christian misogynist sexist environment details here not unique. happens in other places, but these are big companies and they really do get our attention.
Jaime, before we let you go, we want to want you to tell us about what's happening apparently next week, starting Monday on Twitter. What is
it? Oh my goodness. If you love a good old Twitter rant, you're going to love what's going to be happening very soon on Twitter. You know when you add maybe a GIF, an image, a poll?
Kaboom.
Yes, that's 20 characters gone from your 140 characters. As for Monday, Twitter is going to be take that out of your 140 characters limit. So then you can tweet and add a picture and you actually have a 440 characters. If your name is at the beginning and that takes out some of the characters, well, they're not going to count that either. So that should be rolling in on Twitter from September the 19th. Have your rant in a full 140 characters.
Kind of takes the challenge out of it, doesn't it?
It's still quite challenging.
Femi Oke hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much for joining us, Femi. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Comedian Bill Maher returns to the airwaves tonight with his HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. It's a weekly show that mixes news with entertainment and Maher's liberal politics.
Did you see Hillary's speech? I thought she was pretty good last night, I gotta say. She laid out the choice for America. Do you want a woman who excels when the stakes are high or a guy who sells steaks and sounds like he's high?
I spoke with Bill Maher back in June when we broadcast from Los Angeles during the California primary, back when Bernie Sanders' campaign was on its last legs. And I started by asking him what he brings to the national conversation.
Well, hopefully always humor. We're on an entertainment network, so if we're not entertaining people, they'll get rid of us. But beyond that, I have always believed that in show business, you have to do something no one else is doing. And I think what always has been the bond between myself and the audience is an unflinching honesty about both sides. I said it a couple of weeks ago that I have never been afraid to tell liberals when they have spinach on their teeth. Metaphorically, of course.
Well, and in fact, you've in this campaign, you've endorsed Bernie Sanders, which...
Oh, sure.
And you've said on your show that most of your audience, you think, would agree with you on that, that they're Sanders people rather than Hillary people.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Obviously, the facts speak for themselves. Hillary Clinton has gotten more votes. That's just a fact. Do her rallies attract as many people? Absolutely not. But that's probably because her people are not the type who want to go out to a rally. I mean, to go out to a political rally, I wouldn't do it either. You know, it's for a lot of people, it's free entertainment. You know, it's like standing on the side of the road when the marathon runners go by. Would I do that? No.
Well, but do you think that he still has any chance of being the nominee of the party at this point?
Slim. But it's the weirdest year ever in politics, so I don't blame him for staying in. She could have a health issue, and he would be left standing. Something that we don't foresee with the email situation. Now, I've always said the email thing is a big nothing burger, but it matters to people. I still don't think it's anywhere near disqualifying, but it did give me pause as a comedian to keep doing jokes about how much of a nothing it is.
Hmm. Would you get behind her enthusiastically, though, if she becomes the nominee of the party?
Well, enthusiastic is a strong word. let's not go nuts here. I've always said, my joke always was that the phrase "ready for Hillary" was the most accurate, honest political phrase slogan I've ever heard, because it completely sums up how I feel about her. Are you ready for Hillary? Yes, I'm ready. It's like getting a shot.
Right.
I'm ready.
That's what you said, right?
My sleeve is rolled up. Just give it to me. I don't want to get Zika virus. But that's not enthusiasm, exactly.
I feel like as I've watched you talk about Donald Trump, that you feel like you have some insight that maybe other people don't about why he's been so successful, that you as somebody, I mean, you're from the same region of the country that he is, although so many people are, but also that you're both entertainers, that maybe that there, you see something about why he's been able to tap into such popular support among Republicans, at least.
Well, what we do have in common is politically incorrect. That is true. I said that from the very beginning, that this country has been choking on political correctness for over two decades, because after all, I had a show called Politically Incorrect that started in 1993. So obviously it bugged me back then, and it was something that was bubbling up in America. And obviously I did a miserable job of driving a stake through its heart, because it's never gotten better and only gotten worse, especially with the internet. As far as recognizing Donald Trump as somebody from my childhood, yes. Because if you're an East Coast person, you knew this guy. The guy who's going to get you a deal. I'm going to get you a great deal. I know a guy who knows a guy. It's very close to, it fell off the back of a truck, you know. And that is a salesman, and that's what he is. But maybe the election will just have enough time for people to catch on to this. I think they should read his book, or at least excerpts from it, The Art of the Deal, because he does a lot of that in the book, tells you how you can fool people. And maybe before the election, they will realize, oh, that is what this con man is doing to us.
You mentioned Politically Incorrect, which was the show that you had before the show that you have on HBO. And of course, famously, we remember what happened after 9/11 and that show ended. Have you said anything in the course of your career on television that you think did go too far? Obviously, you don't believe that that did, but anything else?
You're referring to the tragic events of 9/17, as we call it around the office here.
Yeah, right.
When I was unceremoniously canned by ABC back in 2001, have I ever said anything that I would? I'm sorry. Was it that I want to take back?
That you'd take back, or you think went too far?
Oh, sure. Almost weekly. that's what happens when you do a live show. You know, we're live. I know everything is called live now, which really just means we were all alive when we taped this. But our show is actually live. There's no redoing or editing. And every week I feel like there's something that I would like to have sort of done over in some way. And I have a lot of trouble sleeping on Friday night, often because I just turn the show over.
You're thinking back to what you said.
Yeah, I turn the show over in my mind, and I'm thinking, oh, I was a little hard on that guy on that point, or, oh, I wish I got to finish my point here where they cut me off. Now people will think I meant when I meant this other thing. Stuff like that.
Well, one of the other things about your show right now that I think is an important difference between it and so many of the other shows that discuss the things that you discuss on that show, political stories, news stories, is that you're based in Los Angeles, which means you're outside of the sort of Northeast media bubble. And
thank
also
God.
The people that you're bringing on the show are not the typical people that get to discuss politics all day long on cable news channels.
Well, I do think we see the same media wherever we are, but California is by far the largest state, and in many ways the state that is leading the nation in so many areas, because it's the only state that is completely run by liberals. We shouldn't have two senators. We should have 28, you know. And
I saw you suggest that to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
He didn't like that idea.
Went over like a lead balloon with him. but, you know, Rush Limbaugh does his show in his underwear from Florida, doesn't he? Would it really matter if Rush Limbaugh was in Florida, New York, California, or on the moon? He'd be the same idiot wherever he is.
Bill Maher, why did you get into politics and political analysis in the first place?
Because of my family background. My father was a radio newsman back in the days when radio stations had news on the hour every hour, no matter what station it was, even WABC in New York with Cousin Brucie counting down the top 20, which my ear was glued to from the ages of 11 to 14. Mm. Even they, and it bugged me to no end, had to interrupt the top 20 so that at the top of the hour we could hear some idiot talk about the news for 5 minutes. Well, my father was that guy on another station, a number of other stations. And so news and talking about news was always in my house. But it was always what interested me. And so it was sort of natural when I got into comedy that that would be the subject that I was drawn to.
And in fact, you yourself have taken that to the next level now and gotten involved in politics in terms of giving money to, certainly to the super PAC, $1 million, famously, right, as we know. Are you going to give this time?
No. First of all, well, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if Hillary needs it this time. I certainly don't feel about her as strongly as I did about Obama. But the truth is that if Trump were to win, it would be way worse than if Mitt Romney ran.
You haven't mentioned Gary Johnson, by the way, which sort of surprised me because he's obviously with you on the marijuana issue.
Well, look, who's not really with me on the marijuana issue at this point? And as far as the libertarians go, I mean, I watched that Gary Johnson convention. I like Gary Johnson, and he's a smart, reasonable guy, and so is William Weld. But all these people, all these years, who say to me, oh, you're such a turncoat, you're not a real libertarian, who would want to be with those morons? These people who were booing the fact that Gary Johnson said he supports the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So somewhere along the way, the libertarians got taken over by just a bunch of kooks for the most part. And I don't want to be associated with people like that. There's a reason why that party doesn't do well, because we already have a party full of kooks. It's called the Republicans.
Bill Maher, a comedian and host of Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Our conversation with Bill Maher first aired in June. His show returns tonight on HBO. Shares of Deutsche Bank have taken a hit today after news that the Justice Department wants the German bank to pay $14 billion to settle an investigation into risky mortgage practices leading up to the financial crisis. Jörg Eigendorf, head of communications at Deutsche Bank, told CNBC that the bank is not planning to pay the $14 billion.
This is a number, it's a very high number. This was a case with other banks, and we all saw that these numbers go down significantly then. And so we are very confident that we will be able to negotiate this number significantly down.
And Mike Regan is columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, before we get to the settlement, is that really possible that they could negotiate it down at this point?
I think it is possible, but what's unusual is that, and as the spokesman there was saying, other banks have negotiated with the government to bring down that initial settlement offer somewhat. What's unusual is that they're being so public about it and, you know, coming out in the open and saying this is too high, we're not going to pay it. So it's a bit of a shock to the stock market. Like you said, the shares are in the U.S., the Deutsche Bank shares are down about 10%. So definitely a surprise, both how big the settlement offer was, but also that they're pushing back so vehemently against it.
Well, and let's talk about what this is all about. We say risky mortgage practices leading to the financial crisis. What exactly did Deutsche Bank do, or is the government saying that Deutsche Bank did?
Well, we'll have to, you know, come out and see in the settlement what exactly, you know, they accuse them of. But it's like all of the other banks, loose underwriting standards, the packaging of them into securities. And that whole process was riddled with a lot of irregularities that basically led to a lot of the problems we saw in the financial crisis.
And there have been many other banks that have been in settlements like this. We've seen settlements with Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase as well. We're 8 years away from when all of this happened. Do we expect more?
Well, yeah, like you said, all of the major U.S. banks have settled with the government. And keep in mind, it's not just the Department of Justice Task Force, which this settlement talks are with. It's also the Federal Housing Finance Agency. And there's been a lot of state lawsuits, too. But most of the big European banks are still pending. RBS, Credit Suisse, HSBC, Barclays and UBS, all of their settlements with the Department of Justice are still in the works. So clearly, they're probably all watching these negotiations pretty closely.
And yet, all of these banks that we've been talking about are still standing. Does this kind of stuff even hurt them at all?
It certainly hurt them. I mean, you're looking at legal bills in the neighborhood of $200 billion in aggregate. And one of the really interesting legacies, I think, is that if you look back at the financial crisis, and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan just spoke about this recently, he reminded everyone that some of the big banks were very cooperative with the government. J.P. Morgan, at the government's request, took over Bear Stearns as it was failing. And Jamie Dimon came out this week and said, you know, that's never going to happen again because J.P. Morgan then had to pay fines and settlements based on the Bear Stearns practices, even though they, you know, took them over at the government's request. So the relationships between the government and banks is not very good, to say the least.
Yeah. Mike Regan with Bloomberg Gadfly. Thank you.
Thank you.
2 years ago, many Americans were fixed on the plight of more than 200 high school girls in Nigeria. Militants with a terrorist group known as Boko Haram had stormed the students' dormitory and kidnapped them. American college students responded with the cry, "Bring back our girls." Most of those kidnapped are still in captivity. Many of them have been married off to militants and have given birth to their children. And Boko Haram has abducted thousands more girls in the northeastern part of Nigeria. The militia has helped create a humanitarian crisis that's brought this part of Nigeria to the point of famine. There's an American woman from Southern California who is witnessing all of this firsthand. Her name is Margie Ensign. She's the president of the American University of Nigeria and is in Washington this week. Her work in Yola, Nigeria happens on a grand scale and a personal one. We'll start with the personal. After Boko Haram first kidnapped the young women and brought them to their camp, Dr. Ensign and her security chief did something daring and dangerous.
One very early morning, we got into unmarked Toyota vans and drove and met 11 young women and parents who at the time were still alive, who were willing to take a big risk and come to the university and finish their education.
Now, you should say the Boko Haram fighters could apprehend you at any time, but the girls and their families were, it's almost like they were waiting for you.
They were. It was quite extraordinary. We didn't know exactly where they would be, and I had mistakenly left a tiny logo of the university on the driver's side of our car, and as we pulled up to a corner, a whole group of people started waving at us, and I knew we had found them.
You mean because they had seen the logo?
They saw the logo.
And,
yes.
And that was a mistake on your part, but it turned out to be a beneficial
mistake. It was a good mistake.
A good mistake.
Exactly.
So you were able to get how many of the girls back then?
Well, that morning we brought 11. We now have 24. They are some of the most extraordinary young people I've ever been associated with or taught in my life. 6 are now fully enrolled at the university, and they're going to be doctors and lawyers and architects, and all of them want to go back to Chibok and build their community. They're extraordinary.
What did they have to be acclimated to after their time with Boko Haram?
To be really honest, they don't still want to talk about it. I think they've really tried to just move beyond that. We know some of them were terrorized, and those that were are still having some challenges, but they really have moved forward. They don't talk about it. They talk to each other. They're a very religious group of young women, so when things are challenging for them, they get together and hold hands and pray, and they find their strength from that and from each other. But if you saw them, you would just think there are any other young people in college who are excited about what they're going to do with their lives.
So the larger picture here is an extraordinarily serious one. I know that the president of Nigeria had really waged an offensive against Boko Haram. I wonder if you can tell us if that has been successful and what the other severe problems are that the area is facing now.
So you're right. President Buhari has pushed them back. There are only a few strongholds left now in places like the Sambisi Forest and so on. That doesn't mean they can't still threaten people. There have been many, many incidents of suicide bombings. And so they still have that capacity. So the security situation has improved, but in its wake is a bigger set of problems. And we're kind of at the front lines of that again. And I think it's so important that your listeners understand what's happening now. So Boko Haram has been pushed back, but the World Food Organization estimates there may be over 4 million people on the verge of starvation.
Wait, how did this happen?
The three states most effective, Adamawa, where we are, Borno, and Yobe, there have been millions of people away from their homes. Their homes are farms. Because Boko Haram has now been pushed back, they're going home. The majority were not able to plant food for this year. We were this summer able to get seeds to 70,000. That was a drop in the bucket. So it's not a threat of starvation. We are in the middle of a famine. It's why I'm here in Washington trying to raise the alarm. With everything happening around the world, from Syria to many other hotspots, it is not on anyone's radar what this region now looks like. I've seen it firsthand. I know how much more is out there. So we were here to try to raise awareness and action by the U.S. government to respond to this famine. And the reason we're here is that the university established a peace initiative years before Boko Haram started, thank goodness. And we've used that peace initiative. During the height of it, we were feeding almost 300,000 people. We have programs now. The most important is called Feed and Read, because in Boko Haram's wake, there are tens of thousands of children who have been orphaned. Feed and Read is literally one meal a day and teaching children how to read to give them the semblance of a normal life and education. The waiting lists are so huge that these children not in the program show up for their one meal, and the children who are in it share their one meal. So we came to say three things to the U.S. Congress and anyone who will listen to us. First, we have a model, the university with its peace initiative, that kept young people in Yola from joining Boko Haram. We can document how we did that. The world needs to know these positive stories about how you prevent young people from joining terrorist groups. Secondly, we're in the middle of a famine. The world, we hope, will listen and respond. And third, we now have peace structures throughout the Northeast, the three affected states, that can get food to the grassroots level, to the most vulnerable people. We did that with seeds this summer. We can do it again with food if anybody will listen and support us.
When you testified before this congressional panel to tell them what's happening in Nigeria, what was the response?
Great surprise. We had people from the State Department there, from aid, from even Homeland Security.
That must be distressing.
I think it's what we've lived through the last 3 years, so it's not surprising to me. Frankly, African challenges are often not recognized in the rest of the world because we simply don't have the knowledge to understand what's happening, and we paint a very wide picture of the whole continent when it's, as you know, it's huge. It's, you know, many, many countries. So I guess I wasn't surprised, but I just hope that someone hears this message, because we can help solve this for not very much money. We can get to many of those people. And our worry is not only that people are starving, but if the U.S. and others and the Nigerians don't jump on this and solve it, this cycle of violence that has really stopped could start again. The levels of desperation, the levels of poverty are so high, and there's been much progress, and we're hoping that we'll get some support for this.
Right, because the problems as you see them up close on the ground are widespread famine, and also, as you've said, Nigeria is home to the biggest population of out-of-school children in the world.
Yes.
And when that happens, there is more threat that they will be entranced and indoctrinated into a terrorist group such as Boko Haram?
Absolutely. And we've made progress with that. The U.S. gave us a small amount of money for a pilot program. I'll tell you quickly. It's called TELA, Technology Enhanced Learning for All. 20,000 out-of-school children listen to radio like yours. And 2,000 my computer science students and faculty wrote apps in the two local languages, Hausa and Fulfulde. We had 5 months to see if we could make a 50% improvement. Last week, the data came out. It's between 85 and 98%.
Of what?
So we improvement in reading and math. It's extraordinary. And so if we could expand this, as you said, there are 11 million children out of school before the insurgency. There's another 3 million in our region. If we could expand the radio and the tablet computers, that might sound crazy in a poor part of the world, but these young kids you know, want to learn on the technology too, using the new technology. So we're thrilled with the results. And we know if we can expand that program, we could get to those 3 million in our region. The hunger for education is unlike anything I've seen. And again, if we can get the support, we can expand these programs. It might not seem much to us sitting here in the West, but for these children, this is life, this is hope, this is education, this is saying we care about you. For the older children, especially the boys, I've had way too many tell me it was either you, meaning our university programs, or Boko Haram.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. Margie Ensign, president of the American University of Nigeria in Yola, Nigeria. She's speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a hot summer, so you won't be surprised to hear that every state in the continental U.S. and Alaska was warmer than average, 2.1 degrees above average, to be exact. And that hot and humid weather can be dangerous for some. Colorado, it turns out, is among the states with the fastest warming summers, and they're trying to adapt to their changing climate. John Daly from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio reports.
It's September at Tre Vista Elementary School in Denver. That usually means it's back to school season, and it is hot.
Once you have all discussed a definition around human rights, what's your last...
Jessica Mullen's fifth grade classroom is on the west side of the 1930s era brick building. The school has no AC. Mullen says during warm months, the room gets toasty.
You're sweating, the kids are sweating. Kids get lethargic because it's so warm inside.
Student Tatiana Bell says that makes it tough to concentrate.
It's pretty hard because you're so hot you can't stop moving around and stuff.
The assistant facilities manager, Samuel Martinez, takes me around the building. In one class, his handheld thermometer reads 82 degrees. In another room on the top floor with big windows, Martinez records the hottest temperature. It's even hotter than outside.
Whoa, 89.2. So, I mean, that's almost 90 degrees. That's hot.
Hot buildings, schools, offices, and homes are the new normal. Temperatures in Colorado rose by 2 degrees Fahrenheit between 1977 and 2006. They're projected to go up another 4 degrees by mid-century. Todd Sanford is a climate scientist with Climate Central.
Among other climate risks, summer heat risk in Colorado does appear to be increasing from what we've seen in the past decades, and likely future projections show more of the same, if not more.
Heat kills more people in the U.S. than all other weather-related hazards combined. That may seem surprising, but when the body gets hot, it has a hard time cooling down. Besides the risk of death, heat can cause problems like heat stroke, dehydration, cramps, exhaustion, dizziness, and vomiting. Todd Sanford warns,
this is a public health threat.
Most at risk, young children, also people with pre-existing medical conditions, and the elderly. That describes many of the folks who meet at the Swansea Recreational Center on Denver's north side.
Regular bingo, four corners, small diamond, any five in a row, all right?
A group of five women are here to play their regular bingo game. They're talking about the heat today with Malaka Getabecha. He's program coordinator for climate resiliency projects and works for a nonprofit called Groundwork Denver.
So if anyone's interested, this is an 11-question survey, which if you fill out...
Getabecha is doing a survey asking older residents how they handle the heat, how they keep cool, and whether they have AC. All of them say they know heat can be dangerous. Bertha Portales, who's 83, says summer heat complicates her respiratory problems.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, in the summer when the ozone's bad, I can't go outside. I can't breathe. I have such a time, so I don't go outside all day.
Heat waves in places like Chicago and Europe have claimed many lives. Seniors living alone without good cooling are particularly vulnerable. Getabecha says his group is developing an extreme heat plan based on the survey.
It could really be something that makes a difference of saving someone's life when it comes to extreme heat and heat waves coming in.
Likewise, the wheels are in motion for the city of Denver.
So we're essentially right here in this little red spot. And you can tell
Sarah Davis works in the city forester's office. We're on the city's north side in an area with little tree cover, like many low-income neighborhoods.
And when you look at this map, you can really tell that the hottest areas match those with the most unshaded, impervious surfaces. So our
Davis says the city aims to plant thousands of shade trees in right-of-ways. Denver is creating a vulnerability map to see exactly which populations are most at risk. Dave Erickson, the city's senior environmental administrator, says they've already adopted a climate change adaptation plan.
It's a slow-motion train wreck in a sense that we're seeing these changes gradually evolve, and we want to be able to adapt to those changes.
Back at Tre Vista Elementary, a window fan churns in virtually every room. This fall, voters will weigh in on a bond proposal that includes cooling upgrades in dozens of Denver schools, including this one. The cost? $70 million. And that's just one district in a warming state where many buildings were constructed for a cooler climate. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly in Denver.
Well, as we close out this hour, a funny thing happened about 20 minutes ago. At the end of one of our segments, I said, "It's Here and Now," which, by the way, I've been trying to say less of because it triggers people's iPhones. They think I'm saying, "Hey, Siri." Well, it did on both Lisa's iPhone and our engineer Paul's iPhone in the other room. They both woke up. So I'm sorry, Siri. I didn't mean to wake you. I will try to stop saying "It's Here and Now" and instead say "This is Here and Now." Maybe that will work. Here and Now is a production. By the way, it didn't trigger your iPhone.
It's not
true.
It's listening, but doing nothing.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.